back in the middle of London and no sign of Dickens. Well, he's a young fellow and his first novel's only just come out, so I don't suppose we should have any great expectations. No. Will you have a sing-song?
Yes!
You will? Good, come along then. The little old woman set off in a trot to fetch her quartern of hot, hot, hot. She swallowed one glass and it was so nice, she tipped off another in a trice. The glass she filled till the bottle shrunk, and this little woman, they say, got
drunk!
Well, I never. Right-o, liddy-iddy-iddy-iddy, right-o, liddy-iddy-right-o-lay. Well, so far, I've hardly got to talk to you about my world of pantomime. That rowdy, bawdy hotchpotch of variety, music and comedy. As you all know, pantomimes are the most popular and commercial of the theatre's seasonal programmes. But as ever, we pantomime players are looked down upon by the actors of the legitimate stage. They think of our artistry as lowbrow and common. And although Mr. Kemble, the manager of Drury Lane, condescends to recognise the necessity of including a regular pantomime in the season, he still demands that it must be short, very laughable, and very cheap. So no change there. The pantomime consists of two parts. A short opening story or fairy tale of thwarted young love, followed by the harlequinade. In the opening story, we pantomimists are clad in large, loose-fitting costumes, lightly tied at the back, and gigantic papier-mâché carnival heads. Beneath this rigmarole of a disguise, we wear our familiar harlequinade costumes of harlequin, columbine, pantaloon, and clown. We're forced to move ungainly around the stage with large, slow actions, our voices muffled by the big heads. Once this opening sequence begins to near its end, each of the key players edges towards some part of the stage where our overlaying costumes and big heads can be attached to strings and pulleys and ties. Then, at the wave of a magic wand or casting of a spell by the benevolent agent or good fairy, the covering costumes are whisked away through a myriad of slits and holes in the stage set, leaving the characters of the harlequinade triumphantly and magically upon the stage, ready for the mayhem of the chase to start. The audience roars, and the tumult begins. The basic structure of the harlequinade is as simple and ancient as any comedy situation. Harlequin dances in pursuit of his sweetheart, Columbine. They're opposed by the leering Pantaloon, whilst his servant, Clown, creates mischief for all. Finally, Harlequin defeats his enemies and wins his true love with the aid of his magic bat or slapstick. There are no set scenes in the harlequinade. Anything is possible. Although there's usually some point where the young lovers are trapped in a dark, foreboding place before being rescued by the good fairy of the opening, who then contrives a spectacular climax or walk down. These scenes remain key to all our pantomimes, as do the rough and tumble of acrobatics, pratfalls, ghost routines, slosh scenes, crude jokes with red-hot pokers, and all the antics of clowning since time began. For centuries, Clown was a rustic booby, a right old clodpole. He was always the slow-witted butt of others' jokes. But the desolation I felt at the loss of my wife and child had plunged me into a well of despair wherein my comedy was forged. The turn of the new century warranted a new comedy clown, offering more than a fond, bumbling yokel. So I decided to try a new approach and created what forever after became known as Joey. I abandoned the traditional clown's plain smock and trousers. My gaudy outfits of orange and blue with spangles and sequins suggest the cock of Piccadilly more than a country bumpkin. One thing I get from my father is a love of garish showmanship and the ability to command attention. So when my new clown is revealed ready for the harlequinade, it's no tattered motley he wears, but a loud, ostentatious and really rather dandy fitted tunic with breeches and stockings. I've no clodpole's red wig, but a bright, shocking coxcomb of blue, or absurd multicoloured antennae or blobs. I change costume and headgear 2 or 3 times per show, but my makeup always stays the same. Instead of the ruddy cheeks and nose of the old clowns, I blanch my face, daub broad red triangles on my cheeks, and paint wide lipstick with thick surprised eyebrows, all designed to accentuate my expressions and articulate, without words, the glee, shock, fear and laughter of every scene. From this grotesque yet dazzling look, I can ridicule fashionable society. I snatch 2 coal scuttles for boots, a muff for a cap, and I'm a ridiculous officer of the hussars. A brush, a tin bath and a ladle, and I give you a one-man band. Covent Garden vegetables come to life in monstrous human form. Even a line of barrels can become an army of soldiers. My stock in trade is to change the familiar into something surprising or ridiculous or satirical, providing a running commentary upon the fads and whimsies of the year, striking sharply and rapidly at the crazy monstrosities of the age in which we live. In pantomime, all things are possible, and inanimate objects can be transformed to serve any comic end by Joey, not by magic, but as a burlesque in full view of the audience. I brought all my experience and knowledge to bear on my comic creation. My father's training had given me the speed and adaptability of the strolling player, and I knew all the comic routines handed down through generations of Commedia dell'arte players. But despite what some thought of as my exotic foreign lineage, I was born and bred in the urban metropolis of London, so I was imbued with all that made Britain the epicentre of the modern age. We live in a world where the red-hot heat of industry powers mighty engines of change at greater speeds and over greater distances than ever before. Ordinary people's lives are now changing faster and in ever larger numbers. Well, I want my clown to reflect these changes, so I employ every contemporary fashion, gadget and trick. No longer the soft, gentle humour of the old clowns, no. My humour matches the cavalier and menacing spirit of our new Regency age. Underlying Joey's licentious playfulness lies a dark seam of cynicism and violence, which infiltrates everything, just as it does here in London. And anyway, cruelty is always funny for the audience, if not for the player. Even the Times newspaper said, "A pun tells only once," but it is not so with a poke in the eye. There will always be a comicality about a man breaking his shins or having his toes trodden upon. And although they said they found it absolutely surprising that any human head or hide can resist the rough trials which Mr. Grimaldi undergoes nightly, it was nothing to that which my father meted out to me and my brother as youths, nor that which many of my colleagues underwent to achieve notice. Mr. Bradbury was a clown who would perform many wonderful and dangerous feats. He would jump from the flies, that is, from the curtains above the stage, down to the stage itself, and do many other things equally surprising. To enable him to go through these performances without danger, he had no fewer than 9 pads about his person, and thus armed, he would proceed to throw and knock himself about in a manner which, to those unacquainted with his precautions, appeared to indicate an intense anxiety to meet with some severe, if not fatal, accident. I, however, never wear any padding at all. I was working once with a harlequin named Mr. Ella, and one night, a carpenter, whose business it was to assist in holding a carpet in which the pantomime characters are caught when they jump through the scenery, went up to him and held up the carpet, saying, "It's very dry," meaning that he required something to drink. Ella replied bluntly in no uncertain terms and sent the carpenter away unaccompanied by the required gratuity. A couple of nights later, when Ella and I were on stage in the scene where Harlequin was about to jump through the moon, I duly gave him his cue for the leap, but was surprised to notice him hesitate, draw close and whisper, "I'm afraid they don't mean to catch me. I've knocked 3 times against the scenery and asked if they were ready, but nobody said a word in reply." "Well, that's impossible," I whispered back. "Jump, man, jump." Ella paused again, and I noticed symptoms of impatience beginning to appear in the audience. "Get on with it, man, jump."
"Well, here goes then," cried Ella. "But heaven knows how it will end."
And in a complete state of uncertainty, he leapt through the scenery. The fellows whose business it was to hold the carpet were holding it, but as they plainly knew, in a position where he could never reach it. And down he fell. The accident occasioned him great pain and inconvenience, but he insisted on continuing his performance, and the audience remained quite ignorant of the occurrence. Suffice to say, I have always tipped the carpenters and stagehands very well indeed. Not all stage incidents are another's fault. I remember playing a part for which I had secreted a pistol in my boot and by some accident caught the trigger whilst in the act of drawing it. Its contents were immediately discharged down my boot, which puffed out to a great size, presenting a very funny appearance to everybody but me, who was suffering the most excruciating agony. Determined not to mar the effect, I remained there on stage until the scene was finished. When finally the boot was got off, it was found that the explosion had set fire to my stocking and had burned slowly all the time I'd remained on the stage. What was more, the wadding was still alight and resting on my foot. Immediately, I was taken home and placed under medical care and confined to the house for more than a month. Now, throughout my whole existence, there has always seemed some odd connection between my good and bad fortune, and this was no exception, in that during this enforced respite, I received great attention and kindness from a Miss Bristow, one of the actresses at the Drury Lane Theatre. Her care and interest kindled a friendship which grew into a proposal of marriage. We wedded on Christmas Eve 1801, and 11 months later, my cup runneth over as my first son was born. Joseph Samuel William Grimaldi. I was the star of the pantomimes at both Sadler's Wells and Drury Lane, and the future now seemed secure.